Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 88, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Yale Fisher. He discusses tips for learning and utilizing ultrasonography effectively as a retinal specialist and applications of endoscopy for retinal surgery. He hosts a website at ophthalmicedge.org, that's ophthalmicedge.org, where lectures can be found further describing the concept discussed here on the episode. Hey, Dr. Fisher, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine. You found the number.
I did. I got it from Ajay Kurian. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Yale Fisher. Dr. Yale Fisher has been in practice with VRM NY in New York, as well as voluntary faculty teaching residents and fellows at both Bascom Palmer in Miami, as well as Cornell University in New York City. Dr. Fisher also runs the Ophthalmic Edge website, teaching endoscopy as well as ultrasound, and he's here to discuss those things. Dr. Fisher, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jay. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we usually start our interviews with new guests by discussing how they ended up where they are today. So for you, Dr. Fisher, how did you end up as an ophthalmologist and then as a retina specialist?
Oh, my goodness. I guess the easy and short version would be that I originally went to medical school and wanted to be a neurosurgeon. But during that time, I had contact with a gentleman named Dr. John McLean, who was the mentor for Ed Norton, who moved down to Bascom Palmer. And he asked me if I would spend the summer with him, and I said that would be great. I would love to. And I told him I was going into neurosurgery. He said, if you spend the summer with me and still want to go into neurosurgery, I will help you. And I never asked because I enjoyed it so much. So I applied for a residency program after my internship at New York Hospital. And with some problems utilizing or involving the Army during the Vietnam War, I wound up at Manhattan Eye and Ear for my residency training program and worked with a man by the name of Nathaniel Bronson, one of the people who was one of the beginning people in the field of ultrasound. He and I met just on an evening, and he was tinkering with an instrument in 1968, which eventually became the Bronson-Turner ultrasound unit, and that's how I got into ultrasound and ophthalmology. My resident instructor at Manhattan Eye and Ear was Dr. Lawrence Yannuzzi, and he was instrumental in my staying at Manhattan Eye and Ear, and eventually he and I became partners, and we founded VRM, and it's 50 years later. I also had a great experience involved with Steve Charles, who was developing vitrectomy along with Dr. Bachmer. And Steve was instrumental in my learning the techniques for vitreoretinal surgery. And then I went on to doing both that and ultrasound, and then finally endoscopy. So that, in brief, is how I got to where I am.
So let's talk a little bit. We're going to talk about both ultrasound and endoscopy, and we're going to talk about the website that's available. It's a terrific teaching tool that if people don't know about it already, they should know about it and they should use it. So let's first talk about ultrasound. When teaching residents and fellows, you've seen the good and the not good in terms of what people do or the mistakes that are made. What do you think are kind of the most important principles when using ultrasound in their practices? Hopefully they're doing it or did it as residents fellows, but even for younger attendings who are retina specialists now doing their own ultrasounds, maybe they trained somewhere where someone else was doing the ultrasound, now they're doing their own out in practice. What are kind of the key things you like to teach? And again, an audio format may be not as helpful as a video format, but let's see if we can just cover a couple things.
Sure. Well, number one, it's a pulse echo technique, and it's geared to using an ultrasound probe. And the biggest mistakes that I see is that there isn't enough background. And the background usually comes from some degree of information about acoustic impedance and the mismatch which produces the signals that are eventually turned into images. And you're seeing a cross-section in B-scan as opposed to the linear display that you see in A-scan. And the biggest mistakes probably are in three-dimensional thinking, learning how to reconstruct the eye from cross-sections. because we're used to seeing it en face. We look inside the pupil and we see everything in the back. And now you're being asked to use probe on various portions of the globe to obtain cross-sections in B-scan. And those cross-sections are hard to put together. You would think they'd be easy, but if you want to avoid the lens, which is really important in ultrasound, to avoid a lot of the artifacts, because the lens does the same thing to sound that it does to light. It bends it. So we try never to shoot anterior or posteriorly right through the lens. And that's probably the biggest mistake. You've got to get off to the side to avoid the lens. And then once you're on the side, you have to know how your image is registered, meaning what does the image represent? Remember, images are copies. And you have to know what you're looking at on that screen, and it changes when you change the position of the probe. So you have to know there's a maker's mark on each probe, no matter which machine you're using, and that mark represents what's going to be displayed at the top of the screen, and the bottom of the screen will be the other side of that sweep. So if you don't realize that you're changing the registration as you move the probe around the eye, it's extremely confusing. And three-dimensional thinking just takes a period of time. It's not hard to do, and I would suggest to correct those mistakes to image patients with clear media and abnormalities inside the eye, recognizing that you keep asking yourself, what is the registration of the screen? What does the image look like to the left, to the right? What does the top part of the screen represent, and what does the bottom part of the screen represent? And since it's a 50-degree cut, that's going to change every time you move the probe or rotate it or tilt it. So that's probably the primary problem with ultrasonography, is learning the technique of a routine exam.
And maybe the best way to do that is to do that in situations where either you have known pathology or a normal patient.
Yeah, you start with normal because most of the time we can image the vitreous, whether it's attached or detached. And then as you get into more complicated things, begin, if you can, with simple clear media, retinal detachments and things like it, so that you can see what they look like and correlate them with what you can see with an indirect or direct on fast vision, any type of imaging, wide field photography, so that you can say, well, if the image looks like this straight in, what would it look like in cross-section? I often tell people when they start to cut up fruit in various positions. You know, the cross-section of a banana is basically a circle, but if you change the cut to longitudinal, you'll get an arc rather than a circle. And that kind of thought process is what I'm really talking about in learning how to do three-dimensional thinking. The other two concepts for ultrasound are easy. It's real-time, looks like a movie and wiggles, and that's a big help in deciding what's solid and what's not. And the other one is reflectivity, or intensity. The stronger the echo reflection, the brighter the dots are going to be on the screen, remembering that you must be perpendicular to induce the greatest reflection you can get.
But let's talk about common things that are brought up as people are in training or things that worry people. So first thing is distinguishing retina from posterior hyoid. That's a very common thing that gives fellows or young attendings anxiety is, am I seeing just the PVD, or is the retina itself involved and detached? What are some tips and tools that you use to kind of distinguish that?
So the easiest way to do that would be to look at the intensity. If there's no blood in the eye and the patient has had flashes and floaters, and you're looking with an ultrasound probe, and I often will examine people with flashes and floaters first with ultrasound using their lids, not the sclera. I always shoot through the lids and apply enough lubricant. I happen to use a gel, and I prefer one that melts as opposed to one that's methylcellulose-based because the patients have a lot of trouble getting out of their eyes. And I first look to see whether or not the material I'm looking at, if it's clear media, is a strong reflector. And the vitreous face is usually not. That gets a little funnier with a vitreous hemorrhage simultaneously, but most of the time you can tell by the reflection, which is weaker than retina, which has a stronger acoustic impedance mismatch with water, versus just the vitreous face itself. And its movement is different. Assuming the vitreous has separated from the optic nerve and the macula, it's going to move at a much faster pace, rather quickly, as opposed to the retina, which usually is more slower paced and more undulating, as opposed to the rapid movement when the patient moves their eye and you hold the probe still. So those are the two major things, the real-time imagery of a vitreous phase separation, and then again, whether or not the material goes to the head of the optic nerve like a retina would, mm-hmm. versus a vitreous separation where there'd be a clear area between the vitreous phase and the optic nerve. Recognizing the aura is always attached. So imaging it that way makes it much easier to distinguish those two things.
One of the things that's difficult about studies that involve ultrasound is how operator and user dependent it is, right? So there's different percentages in the literature about how good ultrasound is at picking up retinal tears in the case of vitreous hemorrhage or occult foreign bodies. What are your thoughts? Let's talk about retinal tears. How, in the best hands, how good do you think ultrasound is in terms of picking up tears in the case of a hemorrhagic PVD without a view?
Well, it depends on the degree of hemorrhage and the degree of clotting. And it also depends a great deal on how much practice the person has had at doing
right.
that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for tears, they almost always occur in the far periphery. They can occur posteriorly, but most of the time they're about 2 millimeters behind the insertion site of the muscles. So I prefer longitudinal imaging or radial imaging, where the manufacturer's mark is centered towards the pupil and the rest of the probe goes more posteriorly on the globe, just gently pressing against the lid. You don't need much pressure with ultrasound. It's a very big mistake. The pressure isn't so important. The lubrication to get the sound into the eye is what's important. And then you can start at 6 o'clock and aim towards 12, and then literally, by tilting the probe medially and laterally, walk around the vitreous base. If the vitreous has come off and there's a tear, you will see the vitreous, which is mildly reflective, usually go right up to the flap of the tear, and it's the flap tears we worry about the most, and you'll be able to trace them out. And if you correlate them with the insertion site of the four recti muscles or a scleral depressor gently placed in your other hand, you'll be able to delineate exactly where the tears are located. It gets more complicated down at the bottom of the eye where blood and clot collects. It's harder to differentiate a tear that sticks up vertically from the normal position of the vitreous face, but it can be done by movements of the eye, and you can actually see them move. We're less worried about the inferior tears than we are the ones that are more superior, because they tend to detach with gravity and movement. But the motion of the vitreous right leading right up to a flap tear is what we pick up. Remember that the resolution of an ultrasound with 10 megacycles, which is the usual transducer level, is about 150 microns axially, so if the tear is elevated more than that from the retina, you won't pick it up, but they usually are. And the lateral resolution, which nobody usually talks about at all, relates to the size of the beam at 19 or 20 millimeters back from the surface of the transducer, and that is around 200 microns. So if a tear is smaller than that, you probably will not pick it up unless you can angle your beam sufficiently to stay in the tear longer. And that's a little bit more subtle. So large tears are fairly easy to pick up, and I try to do them again in clear media cases so that I keep my practice up as mm-hmm. to what I can pick up, because then I can grade myself immediately afterwards by putting on an indirect and seeing if I got them all. Round holes you won't pick up unless they're quite large, but flap tears, you pretty much pick up most of them. Maybe perhaps not the pseudophakic ones. They're very tiny and they're much more subtle.
Those are great, great points. And that kind of leads in a little bit into our next topic, which is endoscopic vitrectomy. So we talked a little bit about using how the importance of ultrasound in cases where you can't see clearly in. Endoscopic vitrectomy has similar sort of implications. So when do you feel it's most useful? And when you do use it, what gauge do you prefer to use? What's the learning curve like? What should people expect when they start doing endoscopy?
Well, I'm going to give myself a plug here for Ophthalmic Edge, because both ultrasound and endoscopy have a complete series of lectures right on Ophthalmic Edge. And whatever we talk about today will be much more clear, because all of that is animated, at least in the ultrasound, and it's pretty well organized in the endoscopy.
And just to interrupt so everyone gets the web address, that web address is ophthalmicedge, ophthalmicedge, all one together, .org, and has both a physician side and a patient side with those lectures you referenced.
That's just correct. The physician side is what you're going to want to go to. The patient side is really for patients who are losing vision, and it helps educate them as to what they can do to help their lifestyle, as well as accessibility, and also how to deal with the loss of normal vision, which is devastating to most people. And this is run by people, the patient side is run by people who are experienced, either professionally or personally, with vision loss. So I recommend that side. It just started last May. It will not only help your patients, but it will save you a great deal of time for those of you who deal with people with poor vision and require some information of what they can do if they can't be improved medically. And going back to the physician side, those two courses, one is under endoscopy and one is under posterior ultrasound. There's also one on anterior ultrasound to explain to your audience how to do that. But basically, I use endoscopy, and that was your question. Thank you for the plug.
Don't mention it.
The endoscopy is really helpful at times when you really can't see with a microscope. Most of the time we can see. There are many, many things that we can do, but there are moments in time when the microscope is less advantageous and the cornea suddenly becomes clouded and you can't clear it. Suddenly you're doing an air fluid exchange and you suddenly lose track of where your vision is because a small bubble gets into the anterior chamber. You have to stop and displace it. Sometimes you can displace it, and then another one comes up, or you fill the anterior chamber with some product so that you can displace the bubbles away. And really, all you needed to do was be able to finish your job of an air fluid exchange and put a little laser in. And now you're frustrated by the pupil coming down, the bubbles in the anterior chamber, everyone is tired, and it becomes much more difficult suddenly. And those moments in time, if you could have an endoscope and know how to use it, can save both you and your patient a great deal of effort and extra surgical time and extra surgical procedures to try to reestablish a view. Often people will, I always tell people when they're going to start to do endoscopy, you really should start in a laboratory and understand the machine. Endoscopy has been around since the time of Harvey Thorpe in the 30s, and those endoscopes were enormous. They were like 6 millimeters wide, and you had to lean over because there was no flexibility, and people didn't want to deal with them. And it wasn't until the 1990s that fused fibers and Grin endoscopes came out. The Grin scope was a glass rod, and the fused fiber was a pulled series of fibers, usually between 10 and 30,000 pixels. They're all made basically by various companies, some in Japan, some in other places, and then they're put into instruments that you can easily hold in your hand and give you both light and vision. Usually about 10% light goes down the endoscope and about 90% is up viewing. So you can get a fairly good image. It's not as good as a microscope, but it's pretty good if you can't see through the microscope because now you can see and before you couldn't. And the only thing you have to learn is the learning curve. There aren't very many instruments out there. I had built one myself with a company from Canada years ago, and we used it for a very long time. And the other one was made in New Jersey, not far from me, by another physician. And that's the one that's currently available. And that comes in either 20 or 23 gauge. 20 gauge is what I was used to. The 23 gauge came out some years ago, but it's not as strong and not as capable of torquing. So if you're going to move it, it more easily breaks. They've reinforced it, but if you're not careful, you'll break it. But again, it has to do with registration. So you're looking at everything on a high-resolution TV, high-definition, and you're imaging the interior of the eye, again, with an instrument that you're not used to. It's disconcerting in the beginning. So I recommend that if you're going to start with endoscopy, number one, go look at the course on Ophthalmic Edge and then arrange to get some eye bank eyes, which we have done at Baskin with you guys a couple of times, and we should do it again, actually, where it allows you to get a feel for what it's going to be like in an operating room. It's really, really hard to just start cold. You know, the time you need it is not the time to just learn how to use it. The time to use it is in a laboratory setting with iBank eyes, if you can, and then progress to using it on clear media cases, recognizing that if you're using it a 20, which gives you a little bit better image, although not terribly better, and a little bit more view, you're going to have to enlarge one of your ports. So it's a decision-making process of when you're going to use it, what you're using it for, are you going to place it nasally or temporally, and then how are you going to use it? Meaning, are you just using it for viewing, like to determine whether or not you should even go on with a case? Are you going to use it with a laser that's internalized, and it's usually an 810 laser inside of it? Not my fondest laser. I don't like it as much because it's infrared and its burn is more difficult to control. Mm-hmm. I would prefer a frequency doubled green, a 532 or something like it. And I usually put it either on a working channel on the scope or I put it in my other hand. And that's the second thing that you have to learn, which is how do you arrange to view with one hand and learn how to manipulate in a non-stereo fashion on a screen your other hand, and how you move around the eye not to lose the tip of your second working instrument does require a little bit of knowledge, kind of like learning how to use chopsticks. You can't move your working hand until you can view where you are with your endoscope, and that's the learning curve. But once you learn it, you get quite comfortable. And the last part of it is learning how to work on the retina, not laser, which you can apply from a distance. And I usually will light the instruments in my working hand. And I use the the flashlight effect, because as you approach the surface of the retina, the image of your working hand light gets narrower or smaller, less of a circle. And that means you're getting closer and closer and closer to the surface. So there's all these monocular clues that you have to learn when you're doing monocular surgery, not stereoscopic surgery. But it's very, very helpful in tense situations when you suddenly lose a microscopic view.
Well, those are great points, Dr. Fisher, about a technique that unfortunately most people are not familiar with, but is a very useful tool to kind of have in the bag of tricks as a retinal surgeon. And as you referenced, the Ophthalmic Edge website has those instructional videos that people can reference and access. Any closing words about either topic? We covered a lot of ground, and you're, again, full with the wisdom of both the knowledge and the experience with both ultrasound and endoscopy. Any final words for our audience before I let you go?
Sure. If anybody is really interested, they're always welcome to give me a call. I can help them in any way they would like, from direct teaching, if it's possible, if they're close enough or want to come either to either place that I work, or even helping them learn in an iBank situation if they really want to start using the endoscope. But I would recommend that they practice. It's the only way to get to Carnegie Hall.
Well, Dr. Fisher, thank you. And if any of our listeners want to reach Dr. Fisher, send me a message, and I'll work on putting you in touch. Dr. Fisher, thanks so much for your time, and you have a great rest of your day.
You too, Jay. Thank you so much for calling.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 88 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also find us on Facebook as well as Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @RetinaPodcast. And to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback's super important to us. A lot of our episode ideas come from listener emails, so if you have feedback on future ideas, things we can do better, things we're already doing well, we appreciate everything you send in. And everyone who's given us positive reviews in the iTunes Store, thank you, and anyone who still has yet to do that, those positive reviews are super helpful as we move forward. Many thanks to Dr. Yale Fisher for his time. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, Angela Chang, we're the great production team. Finally, the listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.